We live in a very weird world. And at winter time, it just gets weirder.
This is perfect circle in the ice, and it's pretty wild.
Every day, new stories reach us. Stories that surprise us.
It was like, did we actually experience that?
Shock us.
When I came around that corner, that's when I saw him. I mean, he's dead.
And sometimes, even scare us. We've scoured the globe to bring you the most curious creatures.
I would pay serious money to see this.
The most extraordinary people.
It's all about having fun during winter.
And the most bizarre behaviour.
God, I mean, cheeseburgers, damn things.
Using eyewitness accounts and expert opinion to understand a weird world of confused penguins, snowboarding crows,
it's like it's having great fun,
and turkeys that seem to be possessed by the devil.
I was a little creeped out. It was definitely eerie.
We examine the evidence, test the theories, to work out what on earth is going on.
Chris Packham studies a mechanical model of the solar system. The long tongue of a lizard shoots from its mouth, ants in a jar, and a close look at a spider. Winter's weirdest events. Chris tosses a snowball into the air, then catches it again.
Our first weird and wonderful story is all about snow. Now, we love to play around in the stuff, and animals, well, they're no exception.
A dog's floppy ears as it runs through a snowdrift. Then a cat's face appearing from a hole and another bounding over to it.
Snow is falling all around me.
A monkey playing with a snowball. An otter sliding across the snow on its tummy, and footage of dogs and cats enjoying the winter weather.
Undeniably wonderful. But I've got to tell you that the star of this story is nowhere near as cute as that lot. But it does take playing in the snow to a whole new level. Time to head to Russia.
Chris steps inside a cabin and sits by a fire. Then a film projector starts.
It's 2012 in the city of Yekaterinburg in the Urals. And a local family have caught a crow on camera, doing something very strange.
The bird slides down a snow-covered roof. Look, what's it doing? It's snowboarding. It's probably teasing us.
The crow has found a lid from a jar of mayonnaise. And in front of the astounded family's eyes, it uses it to snowboard.
Cool, it's doing it again.
So what on earth is this crazy crow up to?
Corvid expert Professor Nikki Clayton watches the footage of the crow.
It's like it's having great fun.
Nikki Clayton from Cambridge University is one of the world's leading experts on corvids. That's the crow family.
All the way down, back up to the top. It's just doing it time and time again. It's so cool. This doesn't surprise me at all. You see corvids doing so many weird and wonderful things. It's interesting watching animals play, isn't it? Are they just having fun? Are they just messing about? Or is there something more involved? One idea is that you learn quite a lot in a safe environment from playing. It gives you the opportunity to try things out.
And this bird really is trying things out. Just watch what it does next.
One interesting observation is that it tries it on the bit of the rooftop without snow, sees it doesn't work, and instead focuses on the bit with snow where it will slide down.
So by trial and error, the crows figured it out. Clear evidence of learning through play. But that's nothing new. There are countless examples of this right across the animal kingdom.
cats chase string to practice catching mice. And pouncing on stuff hones their killer skills even more. But crows? Now, they are really special.
Corvids, in general, are extremely intelligent animals. In fact, my husband and I refer to them as the feathered apes because when it comes to cognitive abilities, crows are as intelligent as chimpanzees.
You see, I told you, crows are special. And there is one particular area where these feathered apes' brains really come into their own, and that's tool use.
New Caledonian crows in captivity have been observed bending a piece of wire into a hook to retrieve a bucket of food. And jays will drop stones into a tube containing water to raise the level and get the prize. And it's not just crows in captivity. In the wild, the New Caledonian crow uses sticks to catch grubs. And the Japanese carrion crow has taken tool use even further. It purposefully drops nuts onto busy pedestrian crossings. Cars then break the outer casings. And once the traffic stops, the crows safely retrieve their rewards.
Simply incredible. But in all of these examples, these cunning corvids have one thing in common. For their complex endeavours, they get a reward. Food.
But the bizarre thing in our video is that this crow doesn't get any food at the end. So why bother?
The fact that they seem to be doing this just for fun, without any reward, suggests that it's much more than just learning. A number of studies have found that when animals engage in play, their brains grow.
So actually, the crow in our video is doing so much more than just messing around in the snow. I mean, yes, it's learning, yes, it's stimulating itself, but what sets it apart from other animals is that it's growing its brain. Amazing.
Big-brained, highly intelligent animals, like us, and like crows, love to play, because play is good for the brain.
So there you go. Snowboarding actually makes your brain bigger.
Leaving the cabin, Chris pulls a log from a stack under some tarpaulin.
Now, winter really is full of the tales of the unexpected, from the surprising...
Whoa!
..to the scary...
Heads up, right at us.
Oh!
..to the downright strange. And our next story is strange with a capital S.
The state of Michigan, USA. The small town of Vesterberg is home to Jason Robinson.
It's something that I've never seen around here, and I know a lot of people that have been here their whole lives have never seen anything like that. It's unusual. I spend a lot of time outside. I've seen lots of beautiful stuff in the woods, in the water.
For the last 10 years, Jason's been taking the same route to work.
My commute's very short and peaceful. There's no traffic to be concerned about. I notice things. I take in what's out there when I drive to work.
But one day last winter, his daily commute took a surprising turn.
I thought that it was such a strange occurrence that I wanted to share it with people.
Footage of an icy road.
This is Schmied Road, where it crosses the Pine River. And this is a perfect circle in the ice, and it's pretty wild.
I've never seen anything like that in nature firsthand. I didn't have any idea how it happened.
It looked almost supernatural. A perfect disc of ice, almost 3 meters across, gently rotating on the surface of the water. And what's even more bizarre is that Jason is not the only person to have witnessed this spectacular scene.
Another larger disc of ice spinning slowly on a part-frozen river.
These spinning circles of ice have been spotted all over the world.
Feet treading the icy ground, then Chris stepping back into the cabin with an armful of logs.
So what exactly is behind this mesmerizing phenomenon?
I didn't know what to think. I initially thought it was man-made. I thought that some crazy hillbilly with a chainsaw cut it, honestly.
Well, hold on a minute, Jason. That's not such a crazy theory, is it? Remember crop circles?
These mysterious shapes began appearing in the British countryside in the 1970s. Everyone thought they were created by aliens, but it turns out they were just an elaborate hoax made by humans. Could these ice circles also be a hoax?
I had a lot of people contact me and think that I did it. People I know, friends, said, how'd you cut that circle in that ice? You know, how'd you get out there? But the ice was so thin, I couldn't imagine anybody was brave enough to venture out there and make a circle on the ice, on the thin, thin ice.
Jason's right. In all of these cases, the ice simply isn't thick enough to carry the weight of a human. As weird as it seems, these incredible circles must have been created naturally. But how? Well, last year, scientists at the University of Liège in Belgium made a fascinating discovery.
Now, here's a block of ice that we've infused with blue dye, and here's some water. So let's see what happens when I put the ice into the water. And if I just centre it here, there we are. And look at that. It started to spin. But the question is, why? Well, as the ice melts in the water, it chills the water beneath it. And when that water reaches 4 degrees centigrade, it becomes denser than the water around it, denser and therefore heavier, and it starts to sink. And as it sinks, it spirals, causing a vortex. And it's this spinning which turns the disk of ice above it. Look at that, it's doing it absolutely perfectly. And in nature, in the river, as it spins round and round, the edges are ground down and gradually it becomes a perfect circle. And these natural shapes have actually inspired some very unnatural behaviour.
A man with a chainsaw on a frozen lake.
The natural ice disc was an inspiration for this project.
Meet Janne Cappellato, inventor of the ice carousel.
Ice carousel is all about having fun during winter.
Janne uses chainsaws and ropes to create enormous discs on frozen lakes in his native Finland. And it seems that everyone's invited.
A crowd on the ice.
Although inspired by nature, Janne doesn't exactly rely on vortices to get his discs turning.
There's many ways to make the ice carousel spin. I usually use outboard motors.
Janne's creations have become an obsession. And now, he's got the whole of Finland in a spin.
City buildings lit up at night, and people dancing and standing on huge discs of ice as they slowly spin.
The more popular they've become, the bigger they've got. Janne's latest creation is 100 metres in diameter, which apparently is a world record. You could say he's revolutionary.
By the fire.
Now, ice can be a lot of fun for humans and animals, but for some species, it's a matter of life and death.
September 2017. Julie Stevenson and her husband were on a trip around the Arctic when they experienced something truly spectacular.
We were like gobsmacked. It was like... Did we actually experience that?
Photos on a laptop.
On the last day of their month-long expedition, they were anchored off the coast of Wrangel Island when Julie spotted something strange.
What we saw from the ship was a whole lot of, like, fluffy dots. It looked like, they looked like sheep. They looked like hundreds of sheep.
Now, hold on. Sheep in the Arctic? Surely that's a bit unlikely.
My husband was in the bridge. He took his binoculars and looked through and he said, they're polar bears. The director of Wrangel Island Reserve, he said, no, there can't be polar bears, there's too many. So we were excited and keen to go and have a look.
And as they got closer, the white dots began to take shape.
It was like, oh my gosh, there's so many bears. There's like hundreds of bears here. I did get emotional. I was crying and people were hugging me because I found it so moving. It's so profound to see so many bears in one place.
Over 200 polar bears. That's more than 1% of all the polar bears on the planet in one place. Now, these are solitary animals. It's rare to see any together, so seeing this many was simply extraordinary. Indeed, so surprising, it even baffled polar bear experts.
Viewing the footage.
Absolutely amazing. I would pay serious money to see this.
Polar bear experts Douglas Richardson.
I've been working with polar bears for 42 years. And to see that many in one location was incredibly unusual.
Now, polar bears spend the majority of their lives alone. So what had brought them together in this one place and in such large numbers? Well, the bears aren't the only animal on the beach. Yes, that's a whale carcass.
The bears feed on it.
Whale blubber is absolutely packed full of calories. It's the perfect meal for a hungry bear. But the question is, on this remote island, how did so many bears find the feast at the same time?
Well, many animals have a keen sense of smell. But the polar bears is in a class of its own.
Polar bears have an amazingly well-developed sense of smell. The part of their brain that deals with scent is probably more developed than in most other mammals.
A polar bear's sense of smell is actually 150 times better than a human's. They can smell a seal from 20 miles away and from 3 feet below solid ice.
OK, so any polar bear within 20 miles could pick up the scent of that carcass. But here's the problem. You see, polar bears are essentially solitary animals. In fact, they're pretty antisocial. It's one of the reasons why they have such huge home ranges, so they can simply avoid one another. So what could have brought 200 of these animals together within a 20-mile radius in the first place?
Well, in winter, polar bears spread out across thousands of miles of ice. But in summer, when the ice has melted, the polar bears are limited to patches of land, forcing them close together.
Normally in the summer, polar bears are waiting. They're waiting for the ice to form so they can go back out onto the pack ice and hunt seals.
And this corner of Wrangel Island is a special spot.
Now, we've got a theory as to why all of these polar bears came together for this extraordinary event. You've got to imagine that this bowl is Wrangel Island. And at this time of year, the bears are essentially trapped on it because they're waiting for the sea around it to freeze so that they can go out and hunt. But historically, it's this corner of the island where the seas freeze first. And clearly, the bears remember this too, as they've all gravitated in that direction. It's a bit like they're waiting for a bus, except the bus is very, very late, and therefore you've got a big queue of bears. A And then they get a bonus because a very stinky whale carcass turns up and they're all hungry, so they simply can't resist it. And what you've got is the perfect recipe for a polar bear party. Except, haven't we forgotten something?
Like I've said, polar bears simply don't like other polar bears.
I thought that there would be a lot more argy-bargy, a lot more fierceness between them.
And that's an understatement. 200 unsociable, hungry bears. It should have been a bloodbath.
The bears were so relaxed. There was no overt growling or lip curling to chase another bear away.
OK, so why the truce?
The reason the bears weren't fighting is you had this enormous food resource. Everybody was going to get a full stomach. There was a limited food supply. So, say, rather than a big whale, there was a small seal carcass. There'd probably be an argument.
So they're focused on feeding rather than fighting. And this makes for a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I've got to admit to being very, very jealous.
I didn't really have a thing for polar bears until I saw so many of them. Then I got how important it was. And it was such a privilege. I was sort of shell-shocked. Even now, thinking about how amazing it was.
All right, don't rub it in. So, while crows are snowboarding in the Urals, and a fin has us all in a spin...
Ice carousel makes people happy.
Some polar bears are having a party in the Arctic. What a weird, wintry world we live in.
A reel turning on the film projector. Then an expanse of snow-capped peaks.
For our next curious case, we travel from the top of the world right down to the bottom. Antarctica, home to millions of Adélie penguins. Ice and sea and ice. Life is pretty good by penguin standards.
Penguins sliding across the snow on their bellies.
But inland, 70 miles away from the colony at Cape Royd, lies one of the most inhospitable places on Earth. The dry valleys. So barren, it's like the surface of Mars. And apart from a few bacteria, there's no life here, but there is evidence of death.
When you're hiking along for hours on end and you come across nothing and suddenly you see something that doesn't look like every other rock, it catches your attention.
Dr. Michael Becker.
I was working in the Dry Valleys. I hadn't seen any animal life in months, and I was out on an 8-hour hike and suddenly I almost tripped over a dead body. Stopped to have a look, and it was a dead penguin. When I realized it was an Adélie penguin and not a rock, it was really quite staggering. How the hell did this penguin get so far inland away from where it's supposed to be?
And this sad discovery wasn't a one-off.
Photos of penguin remains.
I was usually hiking about 8 to 12 hours a day, and I'd stumble across at least one carcass a day. It is fairly bizarre. It's just clearly not an environment they're meant to be in.
Why these marine animals had died so far from the sea was baffling. But then in 2006, a documentary film crew stumbled across some evidence.
They filmed a penguin behaving very strangely. The group of penguins on the right are heading out towards the sea. The penguin on the left is on its way back to the colony. But this penguin, the one in the middle, doesn't seem to know which way to go. Then it heads off in an entirely different direction, heading inland, straight towards the dry valleys. So what's going on?
Okay. Let's have a little recap on the day-to-day activities of the breeding Adélie penguin. The eggs and the young are here at its home in the colony. And if it's got young, they'll need feeding. So they will travel across the ice to the sea to hunt for fish, and then they'll return across the ice to the colony where they'll regurgitate them. And that's about it, really. It's colony to sea, sea to colony to sea, and back again. But what about that single penguin travelling off in the wrong direction, all alone? What was it doing?
In the world of penguins, group behaviour is hugely important. They go everywhere in flocks. For a single penguin to leave a flock means that there's some major factor that is involved.
So what could possess a penguin to set off on this solo suicide mission?
One of the theories about why penguins end up in the valleys is that they're using light reflected off water under the clouds as navigation aids. And so the lakes inside the valleys reflect some of this light onto the clouds, and the penguins, thinking it's the ocean, start heading inland.
It's an interesting idea, but does it stand up? Is this how penguins navigate, using visual landmarks? Well, animals use all kinds of ways to orientate themselves. We know bears use their amazing sense of smell. Turtles use invisible magnetic fields to find their way. Some birds even navigate using the stars. But scientists have discovered that penguins have another way of getting around.
Some researchers were interested in how penguins oriented. And so they traveled to Antarctica and they captured about a dozen penguins and they flew them to the South Pole, which is a featureless plain. And so they released these penguins and they found that as long as the sun was shining, they all went northeast. When the sun became obscured, they'd wander every which way. And so they concluded that these penguins were using the sun to orient themselves to the points of the compass.
Penguins have an inbuilt compass set by the sun. They don't find the ocean by looking for it. Their compass guides them towards it. A visual clue, like a shimmering mirage, couldn't have confused our penguin. So what was pulling it towards the dry valleys? Well, David has an extraordinary explanation for this very strange behavior.
It's a pretty widespread phenomenon amongst animals, including humans, where a very, very small proportion of individuals have some malfunction in their brains where they confuse left with right. They think they're going the right direction, but they're going the opposite direction. This penguin was completely convinced that the direction it was going would get it to the ocean. The best explanation for what this penguin was doing in the clip was it was expressing some form of dyslexia.
Our little penguin had it all topsy-turvy. You see, in his head, he thought that he was moving in the right direction, and all of the other penguins had it wrong. It was a classic case of mirror image malfunction. Yes, his internal compass was completely askew. North became south, south became north. So whilst he thought that he was heading to the sea, in fact, he wasn't. He was heading off on a long walk to the dry valleys and certain death. Poor little penguin.
Chris walking in snow-dusted woodland.
Our weird world has plenty of strange secrets for us to solve. So for our next story, we're heading to the snowy tips of the Himalayas in India to uncover a macabre mystery hidden in the ice.
The Himalayas, home of the highest peaks in the world. An icy, dramatic landscape where freak weather conditions, knifing winds, blizzards and avalanches are commonplace.
But in the summer of 1942, miles from the nearest village, a mountain ranger stumbled upon a scene of utter horror.
A frozen lake had thawed to reveal the stuff of nightmares. hundreds and hundreds of human bones. Now in 1942, World War II was raging across the globe, and so the British Indian government assumed that these were the remains of Japanese soldiers, that they'd been sneaking through India in an attempt at a land invasion and met an icy end.
So there you have it. The theory that these were the bones of Japanese soldiers killed by hypothermia seems pretty straightforward.
But then, in 2004, more than 60 years after the macabre discovery, a group of scientists revisited the lake to analyze the skeletons in much more detail. And they discovered something remarkable. You see, the bones dated back over 1,000 years. So if they weren't the remains of World War II soldiers, who did these ancient skeletons belong to?
There could be 200, 300, 400 here easily. I've never seen anything like this before. So many people in one place at one time with an unexplained cause of death.
A row of skulls.
Bone expert Ben Goward can learn a lot about a person from their skeleton.
If we're looking at male and female, males have these big brow ridges over the eyes here. They also have usually a much more significant chin, you can see in this area. And then we have to look at other things as well. Were they juvenile? Were they adult? Was there a mixture of the two? A skull's not just one big bone, and you can see one here, two and three. So these lines actually fuse when you're about 25, maybe 30 years old. So we'd look for at what point these things are starting to fuse together.
It's techniques like this that the expedition were able to use to learn about our mysterious skeletons.
There are some young people, some kids, lots of adults, and some older ones as well. And at least 35% were females. So there's a real mixture of the demographic within this population.
OK, hundreds of people, male and female, of all different ages, in a very remote location, which suggests, of course, that it could be some sort of graveyard. That would explain why there are so many people there. Well, it would, except that carbon dating has shown that they all died at exactly the same time. So what could have wiped out all of these people in one instant?
What you're trying to look for is something that would cause mass death. So was there some infectious disease, something like tuberculosis, that went through the group? Now, sometimes it can be preserved in the bones themselves, but there's no sign of any infectious disease in any of the skeletons that would explain why such a big group of people died in one place at one time.
But there is a force in the mountains that could wipe out a large group of people.
Footage of snow cascading down a mountainside.
Avalanches. Tons of snow, rock and ice. They claim hundreds of lives every year, so certainly have the power to kill. Could an avalanche be to blame for what happened here?
If you've got rocks cascading down on you, they're all over the body. You've got injuries to your chest, to your legs, to your pelvis, to your face, to your skull. You just can't see the mass trauma you'd expect from a catastrophic landslide.
But there was a vital clue in the skulls. You see, many of them had something in common.
A photo on a laptop of a fractured skull.
They're quite small, they're quite round, they're what we call a depressed fracture. So if you imagine a little circle of destroyed bone that's sunken in, it's almost like where you've pushed something and it's just collapsed on itself and then sunk in underneath.
So what might cause injuries like this? Human sacrifice? Perhaps an attack by an invading army?
Something hitting the skull that's a type of blunt force trauma. So it's not an axe, it's not a spear, it's not a knife from an invading army. They're roughly the same size. You're talking about, what's that, 7 or 8 centimetres across. So something is hitting these skulls that's about the size of a snooker ball. Probably the weight as well has caused this amount of damage. This is lots of things hitting these skulls at very, very high speed. And they're all in the same area, so they're from here up. They're not from the side, they're not from the back. So something is hitting these skulls from this angle or above.
Now, I'm no expert, but I'm pretty certain that snooker wasn't invented 1,000 years ago. So what was hitting all of these people from above in this way?
From Chris throwing a sneaker ball to footage of giant hailstones raining down.
Whoa!
A car window cracks.
Ah! Ah! I just hit me in the head.
Not only does hail damage cars and property, there are even reports throughout history of mass death caused by huge hailstorms.
Now, obviously, we're used to hailstones 2 or 3 millimetres across, maximum the size of a pea, and even at that size, they can cause quite a lot of damage. But in certain parts of the world, you can get hailstones that are 2, 3, 4, 5 centimetres across. So if you're hit with something the size and weight of a snooker ball over 100 miles an hour in the head, it's game over. And if you've got, sadly, 200, 300, 400 people all travelling together in quite a small little group, and then you get this hailstorm above you and all the hailstones are this sort of size, you stand very little chance of surviving.
Who'd have thought it? Hundreds of people wiped out by a single hailstorm 1,000 years ago. Gives me the shivers. And now, from a Himalayan whodunit to a tale of intrigue out on the tundra, and rest assured, I promise you, this one has got a happy ending.
Snowy hills shrouded in mist.
Siberia. A snowy wilderness stretching for 5 million square miles right across the Arctic Circle, and home to an animal synonymous with winter. Reindeer are found here, in their millions. In fact, there are more here than anywhere else on the planet. But in 2016, disturbing reports started coming in. In the Yamalo-Ninets region in the far northwest, a shocking discovery is made. Reindeer are dying. This is devastating news for the Ninets, some of the last remaining nomadic reindeer herders. These indigenous people rely on reindeer for transport, food, and warmth. Without them, they simply wouldn't be able to survive. This really is the nightmare before Christmas. And it's not the first time that large numbers of reindeer have been struck down so suddenly.
We're going to take you to Norway, where more than 320 reindeer have been killed by lightning on a mountain range in the south of the country.
300 reindeer killed by lightning. I wonder if the mass death in Siberia could have been caused by a similar extreme weather event.
Lightning is a very unlikely factor. In Norway, the animals died bunched up in a very small area. In Siberia, there were many thousands of animals over a very large area. So it was a completely different pattern. And all the evidence is that the animals died over a period of weeks, not in a single night.
So if it wasn't lightning, what could be the culprit? Several years ago, fish were found in a river not far from the reindeer, with radiation 20 times the safe level. The finger was pointed at a top-secret Russian nuclear power complex. But on this occasion, there were no such leaks to blame.
There are other reasons that could explain mass mortality, and that's disease, particularly epidemic diseases.
Without answers, the Ninets begin burying the corpses. But little do they know the danger they're in. Within 2 weeks, 90 people are hospitalised. The population are terrified.
And then a disturbing breakthrough. Finally, the mysterious killer has a name, and it's one of the most deadly diseases on the planet. This is anthrax.
Anthrax is bad for you. It's really bad news.
Dr. Tim Brooks.
Anthrax is a disease caused by a bacterium called Bacillus anthracis. It's so dangerous because if you eat the organism, if you breathe it in, then the disease is almost invariably fatal.
Anthrax is one of the most feared diseases in human history and has fascinated scientists for decades.
The commission members visit the bacteriological laboratory to conduct an examination into the problem of anthrax.
Anthrax occurs naturally. It lives in the earth in the form of spores, which are self-reproducing organisms.
In biological terms, anthrax is one of the most difficult organisms to destroy that there is. It's resistant to heat, radiation, to sunlight, to drying out. It's an amazing structure. We know that anthrax can survive in the right environment for well over 100 years.
And it's that resilience which is key, because this amazing structure, as Tim calls it, had come back from the dead.
In Siberia recently, there has been unusual warming, which has led to the melting of the permafrost. In these conditions, the spores of the anthrax, which have been dormant in the soil, may be released. It's thought that they might have been released from an old carcass of a reindeer that died many years earlier.
Reindeer had been killed by a natural outbreak of anthrax in 1941, and for all these years, they'd been frozen in the permafrost. But now, the anthrax spores had come back to life.
When reindeer graze, particularly on the short swards of the tundra, they ingest a lot of soil and ingest these anthrax spores and quickly develop toxins which lead to their death.
So, dormant anthrax spores from a 70-year-old carcass were to blame. Who'd have thought it? Thankfully, the disease was contained, and both the Ninyets and their reindeer were vaccinated against further outbreaks. Rudolph and friends were back in action in time for Christmas. You see, I told you there was a happy ending. So, from a perplexed penguin to hailstones from hell and a contagious killer back from the dead. These really are strange sagas indeed.
Now, if those stories gave you the shivers, I've got to tell you that our next tale is truly chilling.
Car headlights.
The small town of McAdoo, Pennsylvania, February 2015. And it's a bitterly cold night, minus 20 degrees Celsius. At 9:30 p.m., 25-year-old Justin Smith leaves a party to walk the 2 miles back to his father's house. But the next morning, Justin still isn't home.
His girlfriend called me and said, "Is Justin home?" At that point, it just got me nervous, very nervous.
Don heads out to find his son. It's now been 9 hours since Justin was last seen.
When I came around that corner, that's when I saw him. He was in the snow, and he was lifeless, blue color. And I just said, "No, Justin, no. You can't go, you can't leave me." He's frozen like a block of ice. And I just held him in my arms and just cried. There's my son, dead.
Don Smith, Justin's father.
Paramedics arrive at the scene.
Hi, this is paramedic 270.
We're on scene with a 25-year-old male that was found unresponsive. All signs lead us to believe that he's been dead for a considerable amount of time. I just want to confirm with you that we're not going to work this.
The ER doctor on duty, Jerry Coleman, takes the call.
All signs led me to believe that he was probably dead many hours prior to when they called me. The problem is I could not pronounce him dead because he was cold. If he was warm, he could be pronounced dead.
Now, common medical practice dictates that you can't be certified as dead until your body is at room temperature. So Dr. Coleman instructed the paramedics on the scene to begin CPR and bring him in.
So you want us to work him?
I
would go ahead and work him. Okay, I know this is probably going to be a futile effort, but I think we need to do our best for him, okay?
Okay.
I remember the paramedics kind of bursting through the doors, and when I looked down, he literally looked and felt like a block of ice. I remember the staff kind of looking at me like, why are we even doing this? It's clear as day that he's gone.
Now, my body temperature is normally a toasty 37 degrees centigrade. But if it drops by 2 degrees, I get hypothermia. If it drops down to 30, then I probably become unconscious, and if it drops below 25, my heart stops beating. Justin's body temperature was just 18 degrees centigrade.
We got up to the hospital and I met Dr. Coleman, and he sat down right across from me and grabbed my hands, and he said to me, I'm gonna throw everything I have, including the kitchen sink, at your son.
They tried to revive Justin for 2 hours, but it was just no good.
The only viable way to give Justin the highest chance of survival is through ECMO.
ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Basically, the blood is taken out of the body, it's warmed up, it's reoxygenated, and then it's pumped back in.
They moved him to an ICU unit, and they hooked him up to this ECMO machine. I was praying. That's all I was doing.
As the ECMO machine gradually warmed Justin's blood, something remarkable happened.
His heart started.
I got a call, and he said, hey, you know that kid you sent me down? We got him on ECMO. His temperature is now normal, and he's not out of the woods, but he may make it.
That's absolutely incredible. Justin's heart was beating normally. But what about his brain? Surely, having been starved of oxygen for so long, it would have suffered catastrophic damage.
At that point, I'm thinking, oh my God, what if he's a vegetable? Like, what are they gonna do? And I remember we were all in the waiting room, and Dr. Castaldo, the neurologist, said, are you the father? I said, yes. And he just put himself on the chair like this, and he goes, I can't explain this. And I sat next to him, and I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, if you take an orange and put it in the freezer, and then the next morning put it on the counter, he said, it becomes mush. He said, that's what I expected from Justin's brain. He said, the EEG is normal. I got my son back.
A bearded man strikes a golf ball.
I'm 100% lucky. There was things that were out of my hands, and somehow everything fell into place, so I'm really blessed. When I look at that photo of me sitting in the snowbank, it kind of motivates me to work harder, and things could happen. Bad things could happen, but there can be positives out of it.
A frozen heart that beats again. A brain starved of oxygen that's fully functioning. This is the stuff of fiction. How can this be possible?
So when people hear the word hypothermia, they tend to think bad thing. Actually, hypothermia can be protective because hypothermia reduces the body's need for oxygen. So as Justin cooled, what happened was his breathing reduced and his heart rate reduced down to almost imperceivable levels. Now, you may have even found him at that state and thought him dead, but deep down inside him, there was just enough going on for him to stay alive.
But how do we explain Justin's brain? You see, under normal circumstances, after being starved of oxygen for just a couple of minutes, the brain simply can't survive. Could it be that these extreme temperatures bought Justin's brain some valuable time?
We know that once you get the brain down to about 20 degrees Celsius, it's got about an hour it can survive without oxygen. So when the paramedics turned up, it may well be he was dead, but he had a protected brain. And so provided you can, with great skill, warm somebody up carefully, restart the heart, restart the breathing, do all the things you need to keep them stable, they have a chance.
So, The extreme cold gave Justin's brain an extra hour of protection after his heart and breathing had given up. So as it turns out, hypothermia actually saved his life. Well, with a bit of help from Dr. Coleman, of course.
Dr. Coleman, one single decision he made saved my life, and I can't thank him enough. He's an amazing person.
Justin's back where he was. I mean, he's just a fun-loving kid. He loves life. This is the second chance for him.
He puts a ball into a hole, then celebrates with a little dance.
And unbelievably, it's not just humans that can survive under such extreme conditions.
Wood frogs in North America, for example, can last weeks seemingly frozen solid. Just like Justin, they have the appearance of being dead. Their breathing stops, and so does their heart. But when the ice thaws, they return to their normal, healthy state, completely unharmed. Other animals, like this woolly bear caterpillar, have a kind of antifreeze in their blood. And the New Zealand wetter can withstand 80% of its body tissue turning to ice and still recover when spring arrives to thaw it out.
Chris steps out of the cabin into the falling snow.
There's no doubt at all, is there, that the natural world is every bit as weird as it is wonderful. When you think about it, we've had snowboarding crows, polar bears having a party, and confused penguins. But for our last story, we've got a very peculiar piece of behaviour that concerns our traditional Christmas dinner. And it's very odd indeed.
Traffic on a highway under a bright blue sky.
It was around 6:45, and I was just driving down the street, came to the stop sign, and I noticed something kind of strange.
Yo, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Jonathan Davis. Footage of birds circling the remains of an animal.
Turkeys walking in a circle around a dead cat in the middle of the road. Bro, this is wild.
That's right. Your eyes aren't deceiving you. A ring of turkeys circling a dead cat.
I didn't think anybody would believe me, so I whipped out my phone, like all of us do typically, and I'm like, I took a picture, and I'm like, a picture's not gonna do enough justice. Let me take a video.
Jonathan continued to film the turkeys circling this dead cat. It was almost as if they were involved in some kind of bizarre ritual.
I was a little creeped out. It was definitely eerie. I was watching it and I'm like, this looks eerily like a seance of some sorts. I'm like, is this cat gonna just hop up and start walking away? Some people were telling me that, oh, they were praying to the cat and they were making sure the cat was in a better place. Others said the cat wasn't actually dead. It was sitting there waiting for the turkeys to finish blessing it.
How incredibly bizarre is that? But let's go through this bit by bit. Firstly, turkeys in the middle of a street in a major city.
The first time I saw one, I was in complete shock. I thought, what is this bird doing here? Where did it come from? Probably 20 years ago, there were no calls coming in for turkeys. Nobody was seeing them, and now we're getting up to 7 calls a week. The population has kind of grown a little bit more than it was before.
So where have all these turkeys come from? Have they escaped from a farm?
They are not farm turkeys. They are wild turkeys that are sharing the neighborhoods with us.
Wild turkeys? Why on earth are there wild turkeys in the middle of a city?
Turkeys in urban areas, it's a fairly recent phenomenon that we have, maybe over the past 5 or 10 years, and it has everything to do with people and food.
Bird biologist David Scapitti.
In Boston, they're finding lots of food, and that's in the form of bird feeders in people's backyards and in other areas.
Boston and other cities are now full of wild turkeys. And what's more, These city slickers are causing trouble on the streets, attacking pedestrians.
God, I've been chased by these damn things.
And even attacking cars.
We've had calls of people who feel like they can't get out of their car because the turkey is so aggressively attacking the side of the car.
Oh, my God.
They can run it up to 25 miles per hour, which is phenomenal, and they're not afraid of us.
Unbelievable.
So why are these bothersome birds so aggressive? Could this be a case of Christmas dinner striking back?
Turkeys are very social animals, and so we see a lot of interactions amongst the individuals within those flocks. There's a lot of jockeying for position as to who might be the dominant animal within the group. That's kind of their constant social struggle. And what happens in these cities like Boston is turkeys become so used to seeing people that they kind of lose their fear, and the people can become the object of that social hierarchy, that social struggle that exists with turkeys. Where that male bird is trying to dominate another male bird, and that other one's trying to get away, and he's going to continue to chase him until he feels that he's comfortable in his male turkeyhood.
So basically, dominant male turkeys are always on the lookout for someone to boss around, which is why they're confused when they see their own reflection.
A turkey pecks a reflection of itself.
But Jonathan's turkeys don't look particularly angry. In fact, quite the opposite. It all feels rather calm and measured. Gentle, almost.
Why? Well, it's simple. Because these turkeys are female.
When you have a flock of females, there's always one that is the leader of the group, and the rest tend to follow in line. So imagine, you know, the situation where a flock of turkeys is coming down the road, and they observe a cat that is acting very strange in their perspective. It's not moving. You know, cats can be a predator for turkeys, and so that hen turkey saw this threat and was moving around it to observe and kind of give it a wide berth, and all of her friends followed suit with her in a circle. I think it's just the perfect storm of a strange situation, the animals responding to it in a way that's consistent with what they normally would. So it seems to be reasonable, even though it looks completely unreasonable at the very outset of it.
Chris puts on a coat.
So there you go. It isn't some sort of spooky death ritual at all. It's simply a bunch of female turkeys playing follow my leader. Oh, and I know what you're all thinking. What on earth happened to the cat?
One of the first things that I thought about, and everybody always said, make sure you go back and see where the cat is. See if the cat's gone. See if they ate the cat. And like I said, I never thought they were going to eat the cat, but when I got back, the cat was sure enough gone. So who knows what happened to it, but no turkeys, no cat.
Leaving the cabin.
Winter is a weird old time of year. Snowboarding crows, spinning ice discs, confused penguins, polar bear parties, anthrax, a man who was frozen solid and came back from the dead. And when you're sitting down to your Christmas dinner, spare a thought for the good people of Boston who have to deal with their turkey twizzlers. Have a weird and a wonderful Christmas.